been a wonderful piece so far, in terms of the music, the singing. Most of all, the fellowship that we've been able to enjoy, I think, has just been superb. We had, a very wonderful evening last night with old friends and new, and just were able to laugh and enjoy things. It means so much here. There's a real cross-section here, I've noticed, of old and young, middle-aged, and people from all over the world, which makes it very good. As you sit and talk, you never know where they're going to be found or what their experiences might have entailed over the years. One of the most important things that I've enjoyed here is seeing many of the young people that I knew 8, 9, 10, 11 years ago, perhaps, tagging along with their parents coming to church. And now they've grown up. Many of them have married. They're doing well in life. And they're happy. And you know, that is a wonderful thing to be able to see and to share, to enjoy. A little bit sad for my wife and I to wait to the feast this year because it's the first time that we haven't had all four children with us. And of course, now we have a very fine son-in-law and enjoy having them around, so we miss them. But on the other hand, you know, it's nice that they can begin and have wonderful feasts as well. We've enjoyed some of the other families who are having reunions here, and it gives us a great deal of pleasure to see them with all of their children around and having such a good time here at God's feast. I've been reflecting a lot in the last 6 months or so on the value of my wife and family, on just how much each child does and has, or has, I should say, meant and does mean to me personally. Watching them all grow up in a very short but fulfilling time is a very satisfying privilege. Very enjoyable. There's lots of tears as well as lots of joy, as most of all of you parents will know. But the opportunity to share their thoughts and their hopes and their trials is a special experience and blessing that you just can't get any other way. You know, the church is a family as well, and through being in the church, we also have the opportunity to know and to share many things with people of all ages. And that's fine, that's good. But there's no greater thrill than to be with your own children and to have them cooperating, have them in harmony, have them at peace, and have them giving and trying all together to make peace in your family or at the feast or whatever you're doing. That's what this feast is all about, as far as I'm concerned. It's picturing a time when God can live at peace with his own family that he loves so very, very much. A giant reunion, if you want to put it that way. A time when all of his kids will be trying to help him instead of fighting against him. When they will be cooperating with him instead of causing problems. A time when his kids will be working hard with him, hand in hand and step by step. You know, it will be actually a time for a thousand years when God will be able to laugh and play with his kids and teach them how to use the new spirit powers that they have and they're so awkward with. Can you imagine what you're going to be like and me when we have the opportunity to, as Mr. Spence said, zap, go through a wall and not have it hurt us at all? Or do this, or do that, we're going to have to learn how to use that fantastic power. God will be teaching us in this time of developing how to help others that are coming along in his family later on. How to teach them how to use the different intelligence that God gives us. It's going to be a very happy time. It's going to be a time without any influence of Satan. I bet there's not one person here who hasn't felt the tremendous resistance that Satan put out this year towards coming to the feast. I'd be very surprised if there's any church area around the world that didn't have a tremendous influx of difficulties and annoyances and setbacks and just anything to get our mind off of the feast or to keep us from it. I know in the area that I am and some of the others that I've talked to different ministers about, there has been a very concentrated attack on the families. A severe attack on the families, because Satan does not want us to be able to enjoy the family concept, but to be able to look at it as God looks at it. So we will be living then for the 1,000 years when there won't be this terrible influence of the adversary. But we will be able to truly let down and enjoy our God and our Father and Jesus Christ, His Son, and our older brother and high priest. I wonder sometimes, thinking about the thoughts that we heard in the sermonette, I wonder, truly, Mr. Kessler did, if we really understand just how very much God loves us. You know, we don't think about that too much. We think about, well, yes, He loves us, He sent Christ, and so on. But do we truly grasp the significance of what He is trying to tell us during these festival days? Do we really accept realistically what God and His scriptures tell us? For example, He writes in His Word, He says, if you ask anything in My name, I will give it to you. In the book of Romans, He said, all things will work out together for the good of those who love God and who are called. He tells us that we're going to live and rule with Him for 1,000 years and then beyond that forever. He tells us that if we come before the elders of the church and if we're anointed, that we will be healed. He tells us many other things. He tells us that we will never die. He tells us that I will live within you, that I will be with you, understand all that you go through. A lot of times it's hard for us to understand that John was bringing out. We'll hear it. A lot of the youth in church are a little skeptical of that. They'll listen to this type of words and they'll say in their own mind, through this reason and this logic, they'll say, well, that may be fine and good for those old folks who have lived their lives and who have been in the military and who have done things. But as far as I'm concerned, as I look around and see life, the best deal that I can see is marriage, family, sex, having fun, doing the things in this world that are going to bring me satisfaction. Every one of our kids goes through this in one way or another. And it's a difficult job to show them and to teach them and to get rid of that skepticism and encourage them and convince them that no, that isn't the best way to go, that truly obedience to God, the God that you cannot see, following Him and serving Him is the only way that you will ever find the true happiness that you want. Now the adults, when they see these scriptures and hear these scriptures, and a lot of us, myself included, from time to time, we'll think about them and say, well, for example, if I ask anything in God's name, He will give you anything. You think about that particular verse. And you'll say, well, that's true, but that's down the road. That's going to happen later on. That's not for right now. Or perhaps we'll forget about it and just kind of let life go by a little bit and not concentrate too much on that and think about it as something that is going to be in the world tomorrow. Some time ago, one of my sons came to me, and we were talking about several pretty heavy subjects, about life and about death, about the draft and about the church and about God and about this and that. And he said to me, he said, Dad, I've wasted an awful lot of time over the years, because I tried to appear like other kids. I didn't want to be all those things he used to teach me. He said, I didn't want to be a minister's kid, especially. because of all of the stigmas attached to that. He said, I didn't really want anybody to know that I was a part of this church, because it was kind of weird, kind of different. But he said, pardon me, he said, I'm sorry, I've been wrong. I don't want to waste any more time, because I understand now that all you've said over the years is really true, and that's the only way that I can have happiness. So I don't need to tell you, as a father, how very much that means to hear from your own son. But I couldn't help but reflect, doesn't that apply to all of us like Tom Jones? Aren't we all a little bit reluctant to admit to God and to Jesus Christ that we too are ministers' kids? Isn't Jesus Christ our high priest? Isn't he the one who represents the Father, and that he is just like the Father, so that we come before him as spiritually begotten children? That means that we are ministers' kids. With all the stigmas, with all the ridicules, a ridiculous statement, and I put it that way, that we hear concerning the same. So today I too want to ask you, Mr. Kessler did, to rid your minds of any preconceived opinions or passions or prejudices. Now I want you just to listen to the scriptures and hear what they say about God's deep and very personal feelings about you, about me, his own spiritual family. Let's turn to Deuteronomy 33. Just take a look at a trend that is set here. Deuteronomy 33, verse 1. This is the blessing wherewith Moses, the son of God, Moses, the man of God, I'm sorry, blessed the children of Israel before his death. I won't read through all of it, but let's just pick it up here in verse 12. And of Benjamin he says, the beloved of the Lord shall dwell in safety by him, and the eternal shall cover him all the day long, and he shall dwell between his shoulders. And of Joseph he said, blessed of the Lord be his land, for the precious things of heaven, for the dew, for the deep that couches beneath, and for the precious fruits brought forth by the sun, and for the precious things put forth by the moon, and for the chief things of the ancient mountains, and for the precious things of the lasting hills, and for the precious things of the earth and the fullness thereof, and for the goodwill of him that dwells in the bush. Let the blessing come upon the head of Joseph, and upon the top of the head of him that was separated from his brethren. His glory is like the firstling of his bullock, and his horns are like the horns of unicorns. With them he shall push the people together to the ends of the earth, and they are the 10,000s of Ephraim and the thousands of Manasseh. Now I read that by way of example to just show you that God truly loves all of mankind. There's no question about that. But he is especially tender toward his own children, toward the ones that he has called, toward the ones that he is working with, toward the ones that he is specifically dealing with. He has a very deep, wonderful association and feeling. And we're part of that, and we can be more a part of that as we work and as we grow. We have to understand with all of our being, we have to accept the fact that God has called us, that we are special to him, and that we have a special, different, totally different relationship with him if we are to walk as the children of light. In Luke chapter 19, again, we are touched by the way that God and Jesus Christ feel with his tenderness. 19, verse 21. And when he was come near, and he beheld the city, and he wept over it, saying, if you had known, even you, at least in this thy day, the things which belong unto your peace, but now they are hidden from your eyes. And the day shall come upon you that your enemies shall cast a trench about you, and compass thee round, and keep you in it on every side. And they shall lay you even with the ground, and your children within you, and they shall not leave in you one stone upon another, because you knew not the time of your visitation. You know, God, through Jesus Christ, is just anguish at what was going to happen to the people of this world. We've heard quite a bit during this feast about the things that are coming. In the city, it's a small town. Nevada's a very small state. And we know many, many people there as we come back. My father and mother were involved in ranching there for many, many years prior to us leaving Fallon. But coming back 18 years later, as a minister of God, has really been an experience. Because all of the people that you hoped you wouldn't run into, you do. And they ask all of the questions that you hoped they wouldn't ask. But you know what we found through this? And we've seen them all, I believe, or at least most of them. Now there's a big high school reunion that they're getting ready for, so we'll probably see the rest of them there. But I found one thread that has been in all of the questions and all of the families that we've talked to and dealt with. And that is this. Many of them are quite successful now. Many of them are the bankers, the newspaper editors. Some of them own gambling halls, some of them are shills, some of them are dealers, some of them are this, and some of them are ranchers, and some of them are that. But all of them, when they find out that I am a minister, which shocks them to death, because they knew me way back when, like Mr. Spence, I was convinced he was a rounder when I first met him, but now I'm positive of it. And I'm very happy to hear his sermon because it helps so very much. And you can really identify with it. But the questions that they get down to and ask are very searching questions. Because they can see that we have something, my wife and I and family, that we have something that they want. They can see that we're happy. They see that we don't have a lot of material things, but they do see that we are content. And it's amazing how they try and ask and pin you down and go into this and go into that. Some of them have even come to service at once and may come back. I don't know. It would be nice. But it's also very plain to see that they cannot understand. They do not understand. There isn't the same relationship as Mr. Spence was bringing out that there used to be. There is a difference, brethren, between us and the rest of the world. Now, that doesn't mean that we're better, because we're not. We're not any more qualified, because we all read 1 Corinthians 1, verses 26 and 27. But it does mean that we are special. God has an affinity for us, a different relationship with us than anybody else right now. And to understand that, we must be able to read these scriptures and see what they say and believe them, and then through our obedience to them will come this understanding and this knowledge that all of us want so very badly, because God will give us that way. He will lead us into this end result that we do wish to receive. So the world wants what we have, but it's been given to us. We need to take advantage of it in the right way so that we can help when the time comes. As God says in Luke 13 here, that we will be coming in the name of Jesus Christ and of God the Father, and helping to change the attitudes and the desires of all the world. There won't be any more why me attitudes within us, because we will know why God has chosen us and why He's called us. and we will know what he's trying to tell us. In Job chapter 28, we see another side of God's tenderness and his love for us. Job was talking here about some of the things that God has done. Verse 1, he says, "Surely there is a vein for the silver and a place for gold where they find it. Iron is taken out of the earth and brass is molded out of the stone. He sets an end to the darkness." And what he's saying here and what he's going through is showing that God is the one who landscaped the earth, both above the earth and under the earth and on top of the earth. And he's showing us that he gave us gold and silver. He gave us fine jewels. He gave the man the ability to do what animals cannot do. They can go into and make mines, that they can go into the ground and they can mine this precious material. They can use it for fine things and for beautiful things because we have a little bit of the proclivity of God. But it also goes on to show us here. And again, building on what we heard during the sermonette, we can go on and see here in verse 12, "But where shall wisdom be found? And where is the place of understanding?" We must have this. We can't find contentment or happiness or joy until we can see the comparison that God is making here with Job. He's showing us that all of the wealth, all of the fine things that he himself personally placed in the earth that we enjoy are not worth anything in comparison to the wisdom that he will give us if we will look for it. And also, as you heard, the understanding and the knowledge. Verse 18, "No mention shall be made of the coral or of the pearls, for the price of wisdom is above rubies." Verse 24, or verse 27, "Then did he see it and declare it. He prepared it and he searched it out, and unto man he said, Behold, the fear of the eternal, that is wisdom. To depart from evil is understanding." This is what we have to impart to our children. This is what we have to stand up to, or stand up next to, say, a 16, 17, 18-year-old, or younger, who is really enthralled with the ways of the world. They're fed by all of the movies. They're fed by all of the music. They're fed by everything that is in the world. And we have to convince them that that isn't the right way to happiness and peace, but our way is. Sometimes they will listen and sometimes they won't. A lot of it depends on our example. A lot of it depends on how much we believe. A lot of it depends on how much we understand it. How much knowledge we truly use in the way we present it to them. Because you see, our children are special too to God. And he gives them a lot of help that he wouldn't give other children because they have access to him through us. They are precious to him, just like you and I are very precious to him as his own personally begotten children. Because you see, God did call us. He looked down and he himself, and Jesus Christ, decided that they wanted us in their family. And they did it. But we have to believe it and accept it and then read what he says and obey so that we can get to know him better and see him closer and follow him more and then be more like him. Because that's where then our wisdom and our understanding and our knowledge will come from, and we'll be able to accomplish the things that we need to over and above the pitfalls that Satan puts in front of us. We've heard the principle two or three times already, and I want to use that today as the main example here. We've heard the principle that we can understand the spiritual by the physical. And I think that's very true. Because when we see the physical, a lot of times we can then equate and we can compare to maybe what God is talking about a little more. And he gives us all kinds of examples, and Romans 1:20 tells us that there is no excuse not to be able to understand him, because we can see by the things which he has made.
even to the Godhead itself. So let's turn to the example of Solomon's temple, 1 Chronicles 22, and see an example here that I think will show us in a very graphic way just exactly how much God thinks of all of us. First Chronicles 22. Quite a principle here. We see that David, who is a man after God's own heart, especially at this time of his life, just before he died, had really been thinking about God, and he wanted to build a house for God so badly that he could hardly stand it, and God told him no. David accepted that, and he went on and began to prepare for this house of God. And this chapter tells about how he prepared. In verse 1, he said, "This is the house of the eternal God, and this is the altar of the burnt offering for Israel." In verse 3, he prepared iron in abundance for the nails for the doors of the gates, and for the joinings, and brass in abundance without weight, and cedar trees in abundance. For the Zidonians, and they of Tyre brought much cedar wood to David. And it goes on to explain, in verse 5, he says, "Now Solomon, my son, is very young and tender. And the house that is to be built for the eternal must be exceedingly magnificent, of fame and of glory throughout all the countries. And I will therefore now make preparation for it." So David prepared abundantly before his death. Verse 14 shows, I'm going to skip to it for time's sake, but it's a tremendous study. If you want to look into it yourself, and just see through the lengths that he went to prepare to build this beautiful building. Not much bigger than Ambassador Auditorium, really. A little different shape, but not a whole lot bigger. "Now behold," he says, "in my trouble I prepared for the house of the Eternal 100,000 talents of gold, and 1,000,000 talents of silver, and of brass and iron without weight, for it is in abundance. Timber also and stone have I prepared, and you may add thereto." In verse 17, David also commanded all of the princes of Israel to help Solomon, his son. So the whole nation was mobilized and motivated. The whole nation was trying very, very diligently to prepare for a beautiful home for God on this earth. 1 Chronicles 29. David added to this then his own personal wealth. Verse 1. "Furthermore, David the king said unto all the congregation, Solomon, my son, whom alone God has chosen, is yet young and tender. And the work is great, for the palace is not for man, but for the eternal God. Now I have prepared," and so on. And he went on then in verse 4. "Even 3,000 talents of gold out of his personal treasury, and 7,000 talents of refined silver to overlay the walls of the houses withal. The gold, the silver, and so on would be given so that they could make it more beautiful and more magnificent. Then he went to all the chiefs of the fathers, and the princes of the tribes of Israel, and the captains of thousands and of hundreds, with the rulers of the king's work, and they offered very willingly. And they gave for the service of the house of God." And it tells how much they gave. "Then, in verse 9, the people rejoiced, for that they had offered willingly, because with perfect heart they offered willingly to the Lord, and David the king also rejoiced with great joy." They were building together, working together, and God allowed it, so that on this earth they would have a building that they could look to and know that God resided there, and they could understand that he let them have a part in building it, and that he was their leader. There's many other descriptions here. Verse Kings 6 tells us that it took 7 full years to complete this building. There were 70,000 laborers, 80,000 stone cutters and wood cutters, about 3,600 to be exact, overseers or foremen, plus all of the laborers of Hiram, And all the crews that he brought down, and the craftsmen who did the fine carving and all of the fine metal work. Now that's a lot of people to work on one small building for 7 years. After the temple was completed, we see in 1 Kings 7, when Solomon put all the things that David, all of the gold and the wealth, and all of the different treasures that David had accumulated into the temple, and placed it there for God and for safekeeping. Now, I did a little figuring, and this is a little out of date, because I figured at $650 an ounce for gold, $15.75 for silver, so we'll be off a few hundred thousand here or there. But you know, just the gold and silver that mentions here in God's Word that was used in that building, that one building, represents between $310 and $311 billion in today's market. That has nothing to do with the other metals, that has nothing to do with the wood, that has nothing to do with the labor, that has nothing to do with the land or property, but represents only the gold and silver alone. Now, I don't know how much $310 billion is. I can't even imagine. I can tell you what $3.50 looks like. But let me give you a little comparison here. What do you think happened, for example, 1 billion seconds ago? How long is that? Anybody have a guess? Well, 1 billion seconds ago, Harry Truman was elected president of the United States. It's a long time. That's a lot of knowledge. How about 1 billion minutes ago? Anybody care to venture? 1 billion minutes ago, Pompeii was a lavish Roman seaside resort built on the side of and looking toward an extinct volcano. 1 billion minutes ago. 1 billion hours ago, the population of the world was zero. So 1 billion is a lot. And God allowed man, physical man, to build him a building that was worth that much. And over the years, man lost it, they destroyed it, they gave it away, they rebelled against God. But the point is still there. The point is this: we've heard 2 or 3 times during this feast that according to 1 Corinthians 6, and verses 19 and 20, we are the spiritual temple of God. There isn't a physical temple being built now, but there is a spiritual temple being built right now, and it is us. His church. Hiram isn't building the temple. Solomon isn't building the temple. God is building the temple. Jesus Christ is building the temple. How many workers do you suppose he has committed to the building of this temple? Thousands, millions of angels, helping us, protecting us, defending us, strengthening us, giving us courage, giving us help, just like they did before the feast, to overcome whatever obstacles came our way, whatever annoyances would happen to us, as long as we allowed God to freely work in our minds and in our lives, He would be there step after step, stride after stride, helping us to overcome whatever problems might come along. Because, you see, He isn't building this temple to fail. He isn't building this temple to lose it. He is building this temple to last for all eternity. For all eternity. And I think a lot of times we take God so much for granted that He must just yearn and long for us to turn to Him, as you heard when Mr. Rice spoke about showing God a good time at this feast. And let Him know how deeply and how sincerely we appreciate the calling that He has given us and the time that He has taken with us and the understanding that He has and the patience, the tenderness and the love and all that goes with it. Because you see, it's just like in a way, a lot of children are so self-centered and so set upon doing their own things that they don't realize until they're middle-aged what their parents have really gone through for them. They don't realize how to be thankful for their parents. All of us have gone through that particular metamorphosis, I believe. Well, a lot of us have anyway, all of us that have lived that long. And we see it then happening again as a microcosm in our own family. But we don't have to be that way with God. We can turn to Him now and change and let Him know that we believe Him. When we read His scriptures, we don't have to be skeptical. We don't have to doubt. We can read what it says, and when we read that, if we ask in His name, of course you have to go through the rest of the chapter in John 14. You have to understand what He's leading up to and how He means it. But we can understand that when we get to that conclusion, that He means that we literally, you and I, are going to be able to ask anything in His name, and He will do it, because we will have the understanding and the knowledge and the compatibility with God at that point to where it really will come to pass. As we'll see the last great day, there is a beginning and an ending. And God is going to bring all of the things written in His book to pass. It's going to happen just as surely as we're here. It's going to happen in spite of anything that we might do. So we might as well enjoy it. We might as well share it. We might as well let Him know that we've wasted enough time. That we want to truly get right with Him. That we're not ashamed of being minister's kids. That we're not ashamed of putting up with whatever we have to put up with, because we're willing to make those changes to be the children of God. He tells us in Isaiah 9, verses 6 and 7, he says, there will never be any end to the opportunities in the kingdom of God. He says there that He is our beloved Father, that He is our counselor, that He is our mighty banner and shield. He shows there that He is the one that is our champion and always will be, and yet He tells us that there is no end to the things that we can experience with Him. We don't have to worry about the physical pleasures of this world. We don't have to worry. And our children need to know this. About all the things that seem so very wonderful on this earth, and they don't have to experience all of them right now, because whatever it is that's in store for us with God is 90 million times more valuable and better than any one thing that we can taste here on this earth. And He proves that over and over and over again. So we have this calling that we enjoy right now. We have then the future of the millennium, the time when we can be there without the influence of Satan, the time when we walk hand in hand with a loving God who will relax with us, will teach us, and will show us, and will instruct us, and will help us. Then He will prepare us and very seriously let us help with the great white throne judgment, when all mankind will have the opportunity to know this truth that you and I know. Then He will bring down New Jerusalem, the beautiful building that He has been preparing for us for how long? How many thousands and millions of years? John 14, He says, in My Father's house are many mansions, and I go to prepare a place for you. That's true. He is fixing you and I a place to live. Not just an office or a responsibility, brethren, but a home. And you read in Revelation 21 about the New Jerusalem, when it comes down, there's no temple there. Because God and Jesus Christ are the temple thereof, and we're with them. And we're living in this beautiful place that even right now He is preparing for you and for me, and is beyond our wildest dreams, because He's tailoring it to us. He thinks that much of us. He's a very personal God, a very magnificent God, excuse me, and a very generous, tender, and loving, and forgiving God, but a God that demands that we obey Him. He demands that we believe Him. He demands that we trust Him. And He demands that we show Him day after day, week after week, just exactly how much He means to us. Because if He's going to expose His feelings, if He's going to be that gentle and tender and loving to us, then He expects us to do the same, just as any family, and any father, and any mother would. In 1 Corinthians 13, and verse 9, "For now we know in part, and we prophesy in part. But when that which is perfect is come, and that which is in part shall be done away." In other words, we can see a little bit, we can understand some of it, but when the millennium comes, that which is in part or imperfect or partial will be done away, and we will understand fully exactly what God is doing and how He's doing it and how He's going to continue His plan through us. When I was a child, I spoke as a child, and I understood as a child, and I thought as a child. But when I became a man, I put away childish things. And He's telling us and showing us through Mr. Armstrong and through the different things that are being revealed and being taught and being written, He's showing us that now is growing up time. Now is time to put forth more effort and more energy than we have ever put forth in our spiritual life as Christians. Now is the time that we've got to redouble, triple, quadruple our efforts and cast everything else aside, so that we truly can learn and grow and change and develop. Because it's just that important, because it says in verse 12, "Now we see through a glass darkly, but then face to face. Now I know in part, but then shall I know even as also I am known." So more and more, we're going to really be representatives of God, of Jesus Christ. We're going to have to let this light shine that we've heard so much about, and that I think you've been doing such a wonderful job with here on this island. We're going to have to try hard. There's going to be plenty of pitfalls, lots of trials. There'll be lots to overcome. But the thing that brings me so much hope and makes me so enthusiastic, really, about this calling that we have is the fact that I can turn to Scripture after Scripture, example after example after example in this Word, and see that just as we saw in the case of the temple that cost so very much money, that God thinks that you and I are worth far more than all of that combined. He feels that you and I are worth anything. We will only respond to Him and truly be His children and work with Him and develop with Him and let Him work within us. So, brethren, I hope that you'll really take it to heart, that you'll have a wonderful feast, enjoy it, but remember how very important that our calling is.
Page number 110, "God teach me that I may know." And after this song, Mr. Stuart Siegel, local elder from the state of Oregon, please come forward.